Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you are joining us today. Well, I don't have to tell this audience that we are facing really severe challenges as a country, and we're watching the decay, I would say, of liberal democracy in the United States of America. And it has come to seem that the only possible solution to what we're experiencing is a revived Democratic Party. But things don't look so good for the Democratic Party, which is why I am delighted to be joined today by Matt Bennett, who is a co-founder of Third Way, and by the publisher of The Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, who is a student of public opinion and studies these things very closely. So let's start with the blockbuster New York Times story a couple of weeks ago that showed that of the 30 states in the country that keep voter registration data, over the last 4 years, every single state has seen a dramatic shift away from registration for Democrats and toward registration as Republicans. Many people are still registering as independents also, but the edge that Democrats used to enjoy in key swing states, for example, is practically gone. So Matt, first of all, thank you for being here. And why don't you give us your interpretation of those data?
Well, thanks for having me, Mona. It is not good. It is extremely bad. There's no way to put a gloss on it. When it's happening in 30 states, something real is going on. And it is of a piece, I think, with the polling that we've seen and probably what Sarah's been hearing in focus groups about how people feel about the party, which is terrible. They hate it right now. Some of the polling, I think, is Democrats frustrated with other Democrats and Democratic leadership's inability to fight Trump in ways that they find robust, which I totally get. So that isn't going to show up in elections because those are Democrats and they're going to vote for Democrats. But the registration data is a whole different thing. And that is really, really scary. Now, that's not to say that we're going to lose the Virginia governor's race this year, or even that it's going to keep us from necessarily winning back the House in 2026. I don't think it will, because that electorate is small and tends to be very engaged and is a little bit higher educational attainment, which now all of those things are good for Democrats. Lower turnouts, good for us. However, doesn't make it easier to win in 26, and it makes it a hell of a lot harder to win in 28 and beyond. So, and I think the final thing is that it's a really scary statement about how new registrants feel about Democrats. A lot of these people, some of them are changing their party affiliation, but some of them are, a lot of them are new and a lot of them are young. And it is very bad for Democrats to have young people registering as Republicans, not a thing we'd seen before.
So, Sarah, on one of the Sunday shows, I saw Donna Brazile asked about this. And she said, oh, yeah, you know, the Democratic Party has hired the wrong people to do door knocking and voter registration and stuff. It's all about that. You know, what do you make of that explanation?
I mean, I think that's incorrect. I think it's possible that door knocking is not as effective as one might want it to be, that the people who are showing up at an average swing voter's door might do more harm than good. I'd buy that as maybe a thing, but not the thing. The reason I think that Democrats are doing so poorly are a few things. I think one, people can forget this. Donald Trump still feels new, even to people, like I think to people our age. But he has been with us now for a decade, which means that a 10-year-old who is a 20-year-old now voting, Donald Trump is not an aberration to that kid. Donald Trump is a normal part of our politics, somebody who has been president before, who's run for election 3 times. And I think the normalization of that cannot be overstated. I also think that 4 years of Joe Biden was a huge problem for Democrats. I mean, the way that it was approached could have been, hey, I'm going to be a one-term president, and while I'm here, I'm going to build a bunch of stars, and we're going to build out a bench. And instead, it was incredibly insular. he ran for a second term when he absolutely shouldn't have. There was very little building that was done, except for maybe infrastructure, which I'm watching Donald Trump and his administration take all the credit for now, because it's all just coming online. And so I just
which was entirely predictable, by the way.
Entirely predictable. And so, like, the ability to just waste that shot, that four-year shot, and to have somebody so old and so poor at communicating that, especially for younger voters, like, what is a Democrat? Was it Joe Biden, that crypt keeper that they saw? You know, like, this is, so I think that's a big part of the problem. I don't mean to be mean, but I obviously remain extremely angry at the asymmetry between saying Donald Trump is an existential threat to democracy and, oh, but we have to run this 82-year-old that the vast majority of the party does not think is equipped to run. And obviously the majority of the country doesn't think is equipped to run. And then there's just like the general out of touchness of Democrats, like the sense that, I mean, the party is old. I was looking at numbers the other day around the percentage of people who are over 75 in Congress. And the vast majority of them are Democrats. And so the gerontocracy is real. The lack of ability to communicate is real. And I just think there's a general sense, like, Democrats, they have not woken up to what time it is. And I think Matt is exactly right. The thing you hear from voters, I did a bunch of series of focus groups where I asked people, I separated them by Democrats who wanted the party to be more progressive and Democrats who wanted the party to be more moderate. And if I showed you those groups, you would not be able to tell me which group was which, because they all have the same complaints, which is not they're not progressive enough or they're not modern enough. It's just they're not doing anything. They're not fighting. They're not out there. I don't hear from them. Where are they? They're old. They're out of touch. And so I think that the left represented online too. I mean, like, there's a million reasons. But anyway, I just don't think it's just voter registration. I think there's tons of stuff. I was just saying, there's a complete absence of leadership on the Democratic side right now. Like, who are the people? Like, Gavin Newsom parodying Donald Trump has been the most exciting thing to happen for Democrats in a while. And that's just somebody kind of throwing Trump back at Trump, right? It's about Trump still. Like, where's the Democrat who's telling you, here's what it means to be a Democrat. Here's what I stand for. Here's what the party stands for. Like, I do think the political realignment that Matt was talking about, where you have all these college-educated voters who were sort of center-right voters who've moved into the party, a lot of non-college working-class voters have, you know, moved into the Republican Party. And the Republican Party's changed a lot. Like, suddenly it's for punishing flag burning and for tariffs and for a lot of stuff that you'd be like, I don't know, weren't those like the 90s, some of the 90s Democrat
taking shares
stuff
of Intel?
Yeah, right. So for a Democrat today who's watching Republicans do this stuff, they're sort of like, who are we in this other than just the opposition to Donald Trump? And I think until they can answer that question and have messengers who can carry the answer to that question, they're really going to struggle.
Well, and Mona, can I make one point about that?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's exactly right. And I think Newsom, as Sarah notes, Newsom being kind of the anti-Trump is one thing. And then the thing that scares me is that the other person that has stepped out as the leader of our party, God help us, is a Democratic socialist running for mayor of New York. And like, that is not good. There is no question that he is dynamic and a great communicator and handsome and really good at new media and all of those things. And he's going to be mayor. He's going to win that race. Mm-hmm. But he's also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and they are crazy people. And that stuff is easily weaponized against Democrats. But all of a sudden, kind of the bulk of the party, the party tastemakers are really gravitating towards Mamdani. And that is very, very scary.
So, yeah, and the enthusiasm for Mamdani is not an isolated thing in the Democratic Party. I mean, let's look at what just happened at their summer meeting in Minneapolis, okay? The DNC, which is not the whole party, but which is the organ that's supposed to represent the party, had their meeting. And the first thing they did was they had a land acknowledgement. That was the opening statement. And then they heard from on the subject of crime and policing, the person they turned to for a lecture was Insha Rahman of the Vera Institute. Now, I have to say, I don't know her. And she says in some of the news accounts, she says that she was emphasizing being tough on crime. I don't know. I didn't hear the speech. But here's what I do know from looking at the website of the Vera Institute. It's all about ending mass incarceration, dignity behind bars, and the criminalization of people of color, immigrants, and people experiencing poverty, drastically reduce the use of jails, prisons, etc. That codes in a certain way to voters, doesn't it, Matt? I mean, it suggests more sympathy for criminals than for their victims.
Yeah, look, the Vera Institute is a very well-meaning group of people, and they're advocates for, you know, cashless bail and a whole bunch of stuff that the left likes, and they do their job well in that regard. The problem wasn't the Vera Institute. The problem was Ken Martin's DNC invited the Vera Institute to give a talk about the politics of crime.
Yeah.
Remember, this isn't like a talk to a bunch of governors or mayors about how to deal with crime. This is the DNC.
Right.
This is like how to deal with the politics of crime. And they invited her to give that talk. And that was crazy because she's exactly the wrong person to be telling Democrats how to deal with crime in the age of Trump. And just the very language that they use, I mean, persons experiencing poverty, like that is just not how people talk. People say poor people.
Yeah.
And like that it just codes, as you say, it codes very lefty. And the land acknowledgments, it's like if the Republicans had sat around and whiteboarded what could be the best possible thing the Democrats could do for us at their convention, it would have been that.
Yeah. So let's get into the whole matter of the way Democrats talk, because you put out a memo, a Third Way did, that got a lot of attention, listing actual words that Democrats should just eliminate from their vocabularies, Democratic candidates, because they're alienating. So you mentioned, I mean, there are a lot of them here, but it really does tell a tale. Microaggression, triggering, othering, safe space, postmodernism. So what prompted you to put out this report? What kind of research went into it? You know, do you have a sense from voters or focus groups or whatever that these are really alienating words?
Yes. So first of all, I will stipulate we did not go out and do a poll and say, what do you think of using inseminated person rather than pregnant woman?
Or chest feeding.
Right. We felt we didn't need that poll. We felt like it was fairly clear that like normal people don't talk that way. And we had heard ourselves in focus groups, and we'd heard from a lot of people who conducted public opinion research of their own, that this stuff is coming up organically in the groups. They're saying, we do not like to hear this coming out of Democrats or Democratic allies. And by the way, voters do not distinguish between people running for office and the people like, you know, the folks at the Beer Institute who represent the people running for office. It's all part of the Democratic world for voters, and it defines what it means to be a Democrat. One of the, we heard some real blowback for this memo, a lot of praise, but some blowback. One of the things we heard was, well, you didn't test it, to which we responded, really? Like, you think we needed to test that? And the second was, no one in Democratic politics uses these terms anymore. And as Lauren Egan Bulwark wrote, I kind of thought that too until the Democrats held their convention. And then, boom, they were using it again. And I have to tell you, we have like a very long list of people using these terms since November. This is not ancient history. And, you know, Bill Kristol and I have a disagreement about this. He thinks that Democrats have put this behind them. They have not. And very senior Democrats continue to use this kind of language. And it just puts a huge barrier between them and the voters that we have got to get back.
So, Sarah, I'd like to hear you on this. I have a feeling from what you said a minute ago that you're sort of downplaying the ideological part of this. You're saying it's not really left, right. It's just that the Democrats don't have a candidate. Nobody knows what they stand for. Matt is more saying, actually, no, some of the messaging from the Democrats is just downright alienating to people, and it's too lefty.
Oh, yeah. Don't misunderstand me. I completely agree with Matt that it is too lefty. Let me try to break down a couple different things. Number one, one of the biggest problems with the DNC is that it showed that there were no lessons learned. And I think this is part of what freaks people out when they see it. It was that the goal of, hey, Donald Trump just won the popular vote. And he won the popular vote after being indicted like a million times and trying to overthrow an election. So like, how much do they have to not like Democrats to reelect Donald Trump? Joe Biden wanted Donald Trump. Democrats actually kind of wanted Donald Trump to run again. They thought they could beat him.
Yeah.
And they couldn't. And so, like, why are people so unhappy with Democrats? Well, Democrats should take a look at that. And I think some of it's language, some of it's leadership, some of it's policy, right? I mean, you know, you talk about the tough on crime stuff. This is one of those things where there is an academic conversation happening. Like when Matt says, I don't have to test it. It's because Matt sits in these rooms. Like, I sit in these rooms. I'll never forget, Mona, you know this. We're conservatives. We're used to conservative world, whatever. Donald Trump happens. Suddenly, we find ourselves in Democratic spaces. And they make you sit in a circle. Sometimes, like, pass a conch to talk. And I remember being like, I knew you guys did this kind of stuff. And at first, and it's like, you know, they're snapping in response to things and not clapping because clapping is bad somehow. And, like, there's all these rules. And I would say to people, I will never stop being a Republican. And the reason I will never stop being a Republican is because then in lefty spaces, they don't expect you to do their weird rituals, like go around and have everyone say their pronouns. And it is a cultural thing that if you were in political lefty spaces, I immediately became to realize like what these rituals were. I didn't quite participate and sort of was like, guys, I think this is part of your problem. But it's difficult to undo a culture when that is part of the thing that binds you together. And I think what Matt is saying is that people do not realize how insular this stuff is. And I'll give you here's an example just from today. So the CDC is having this insane meltdown right now. And there's incredible resignation letters about why RFK is making health decisions based purely on politics and not on science. They are exceptional letters, except they use language like pregnant person. And the guy signs with his pronouns, he, him, his, right? I didn't care. I cared about the medical prestige of this person. I cared about their relevant expertise. That's what I wanted to know about. But instead, I got to know about their politics. Because that's what signing a pronoun at the end of your stuff does. It doesn't tell you anything about the person, really. It just tells you what their politics are. Because it's all a kind of tribal coding that does isolate other people from you if they don't want to do that or they find that sort of ridiculous. And I think Democrats need to let all this go. And this is maybe there's a real strain. I get a lot of pushback on this. And I bet Matt gets a similar version of this. Why are you talking about Democrats and the language they use when this other guy has cops in the streets with their faces covered, is dragging people out? There's a march toward authoritarianism. And what, you guys are going to sit here and complain about the language the left uses? Here's why. The only way to beat those authoritarians, the only way, Democrats are our only hope. They're our only option. And so we've got to get them. Yeah. Thank you. Snap. That's right. What's this? This is the one that's quiet that you do. You know, the only way you win is by broadening this tent. And, you know, Donald Trump sounds to our ears, I think, often like an idiot when he talks. And I don't know. He's probably got the grammar and whatever of like a 10th grader. So do a lot of Americans. They understand Donald Trump when he talks. When you say it's alienating or it codes a certain way, it does do that. But also it just makes people be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, what does it mean to have, what was Kamala Harris's thing? It's like, what is an opportunity economy? Like, what is that? Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the language, like the lefty, wokey stuff. It's also just, no, communicate like a normal person. Talk to me like a normal person. Talk to me like you would talk to your friends. Because Donald Trump communicates at a level that absolutely everyone can understand him. And he's can be, I don't find him funny, but they do, because he's like both, and it's all, because it's also all that language. It's also, it's so self-serious, and it's so like a way to correct somebody else. And it makes people, and we learned this with gay marriage stuff, right? Is that if you were constantly correcting people who were trying, they're just trying to be good people, and they're trying to say, your partner or whatever. And you're like, no, it's my wife. You're like, don't do that. Just be like, yeah, just like, right. Like, don't push people back on the language, because it makes you feel superior, because it does make them feel inferior. And it ultimately alienates them from sort of the good nature approach they're taking to accepting you.
While we're piling on, let me just say that sometimes these changes in language really are strike me anyway as nothing more than a power play. So why do you need to change homeless to unhoused, right? There is no difference in the meaning of those words, except to convey that the new word is acceptable and the old word isn't. Therefore, I am more woke and more sensitive than thou. Isn't that right?
100%. You know who doesn't care about the difference between homeless and unhoused? Is the homeless.
Exactly.
They couldn't care less.
And let's talk about solutions, which I just did on a recent podcast, rather than simply, you know, showcasing that I use the right terminology.
So I couldn't agree more with every word that both of you said. And the thing, the signal you're sending when you use the term unhoused is, I think you are uneducated. I think you are a bigot. And I think you are different than me. Those are not the signals you want to send in politics. You want to send the opposite signal. And by the way, I learned everything I know about politics from Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton used to, the speeches that the speechwriters would send in would come back covered in red, and every highfalutin idea and word was crossed out, every single one. This is not because Bill Clinton wasn't smart enough to convey that kind of thing. Bill Clinton went to Yale Law School. Bill Clinton's pretty smart. But he understood politics at such a fundamental level. And the way that he talked and the policy ideas that he proposed were simple, sticky ideas. I'm going to put 100,000 cops on the street.
Exactly.
That was a very simple idea. You may agree or disagree with it as a policy matter. I'm going to reform welfare as we know it. A lot of people hated that, but everyone kind of understood what he was talking about. And we have got to get back to that. You can pull off highfalutin rhetoric if you are a generational talent like Barack Obama, but there are not many of those in Democratic politics. And that was a very different moment. We have got to get back to a more Bill Clinton style of communicating because of the moment we're in. And the opponent that we face, as Sarah said, this kind of brilliantly resonant populist on the other side.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you mentioned that about the 100,000 cops, because there you have an example from the Democrats' own history of a candidate who was able to disarm the best issue for Republicans, which is safety, which is crime. He was able to do that by being for more cops. What have we seen in the last several weeks as Trump is militarizing the National Guard and putting American troops on the cities, on the streets of our cities, and threatening to do far more? We see a lot of Democrats, and I understand that you want to correct the record, and it's very understandable, you know, but crime is coming down. Crime is not increasing, which is true, but you have to quickly move past that, it seems to me. Don't you agree? Quickly move past that and say, here's what we need to be doing about crime. And Trump is getting in the way because he's spending all these billions on ICE, which we do not need. And that denies money for cops that we do need. Sarah, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I watched Muriel Bowser's press conference yesterday, and she's praising Trump. for putting these cops. She's talking about the reduction in crime. And I was flabbergasted by the way that she approached it. I thought it was insane. But I understand. Here's what's happening is like, and this goes to the policy part that I was talking about before. Like some of it is policy. If you ask Americans, and we do, like in every focus group, we just ask right at the beginning, how do you think things are going in the country? And that's where we get the most information, just right off the bat. Because the people tell you what they care about. They care about the economy and jobs. They care about prices. They care about immigration. They care about crime. Now, they also care about healthcare. That's the one that really, the cost of healthcare is the one that plays more to Democrat strengths. But like, at some point, you just have to say, what do people care about? And how do I talk about that? And if you don't do it, the authoritarians will. Yeah. Because people want, they want a closed border, which doesn't mean they don't want immigration. People do want immigration. And this is a big, complicated subject that we're not going to be able to wrestle the whole thing to the ground. But people want a closed border and then an orderly process for people to immigrate here. It's not an insane thing to want. Right? They don't want people to come across illegally. They want to know who's in the country. They want to know that there's a system and a process in place. Okay. They want safe schools, safe streets, right? And so if Muriel Bowser had said, we do not need the National Guard in Washington, D.C. We do not need ICE with their faces covered, dragging delivery men off mopeds. What we need is more cops who understand this city, who walk the beats of this city, who this community trusts, and Donald Trump is making it worse. You want to give us, you cut our budget. Give us our budget back and let us hire more cops and we'll take care of it. And the lack of ownership for her own city, for her own cops, for her own responsibility. That's like you let the federal government do that when things are so bad that your community is sort of begging to get out of that distress. And so you can't say, yes, crime was coming down because it was really, really high during the pandemic. I lived in the city. I watched everything be boarded up. I watched all the encampments in all of the circles in the grassy areas. Like it was not pleasant. It was scary. I wouldn't bring my kids downtown. So, but that was the pandemic and we've been coming out of it. And so a lot of the crime has been coming down. You still have to say, I recognize that there is too much crime in these cities and that there's too much just like garbage. Like people don't want to live where there's lots of detritus. We used to have these amazing metro systems here in D.C.
Yeah.
And now they're terrible. Yeah. And so like people notice that stuff. You can't just pretend like it's not happening. And you should have a solution that cares about the people of your city. But like, if you don't have a solution, they will weaponize it this way for more power.
So, Matt, I would give you two contrasting approaches.
Matt, I'm sorry I'm talking so much.
No.
This is your show, man.
We're all very passionate. It's not like there's anything at stake here. Matt, let me give you two contrasting approaches to this whole crime thing. The mayor of Chicago, who at that press conference that was convened by J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, he got up and he started talking about how much they've brought crime down in Chicago. So that was one approach. Pritzker said, if Donald Trump was actually serious about fighting crime in cities like Chicago, he, along with his congressional Republicans, would not be cutting over $800 million in public safety and crime prevention grants nationally. Trump is defunding the police, Pritzker said.
There's a reason the mayor's approval rating is about 20%, and Pritzker's approval rating is much, much higher. And it goes to what Sarah was saying earlier. You cannot tell people what to feel, and you cannot use data to convince them of anything. Data is useless in American politics. We learned this last year when Democrats were running around saying, well, actually, the economy is going pretty well. Look at the macroeconomic data. Everything's pointing in the right direction. And Americans were like, are you nuts? Like, I can't afford the groceries. And we just lost that in a rout. And that is happening in some places, at least, on crime. We are telling people how to feel. Rahm Emanuel used to say when he was mayor of Chicago, no one ever said to me, I feel 23% safer on the streets of Chicago, because that isn't how this works. It is a much more impressionistic set of feelings that people establish in the ways that Sarah laid out. And so when you talk about crime coming down, as lots and lots of Democrats have been doing as it relates to DC and as the mayor did in Chicago, it falls completely flat. What you've got to do is say, yeah, we need to be tough on crime. No one should feel unsafe in their homes. And by the way, the people who feel the most unsafe in their homes tend to be the people we think that we are representing by denying somehow that crime is happening. I mean, people live in the poorest areas of Washington, in Anacostia. Those are the people that want crime to come down the most. Those are the people, like in when Minneapolis had the Defund the Police initiative on the ballot, it lost in a huge, overwhelming rout, and it lost most in the Black and Hispanic neighborhoods because those people do not want to defund the police. They think that's nuts.
Exactly.
So what we've got to do is essentially exactly what Sarah said, which is, and what Pritzker said, which is said, goddamn right, we're not going to defund the police. We're going to have more police. And the Republicans in the House have stolen $1.1 billion from the District of Columbia. We need 500 more cops on the MPD. Those are the people that are going to bring, that are bringing crime down. And we need to do a lot more, and we need more of them. And sending a bunch of National Guard troops who are not trained for this mission onto our streets gets in the way of that. Doing ICE enforcement by arresting a bunch of Uber Eats drivers gets in the way of that. What we need is real help in fighting real crime.
Sarah, one would have thought, you know, like earlier you were saying that one of the most depressing things was seeing that Democrats don't recognize, haven't learned the right lessons, haven't seen. And one of the things that has been characteristic of Democrats throughout my lifetime is that they assumed that they were the party of the working class, Blacks and Hispanics, that they had a lock on them. And the youth vote varied, but frequently the youth vote too. And one of the huge lessons that at least I took away from last year's election was, look at the working class. Oh my God, it is just, it's fleeing from the Democrats. And that includes African-American members of the working class and Hispanic members of the working class who are not grooving to the messages that the Democrats are putting out there.
As Democrats moved to make sure to call people Latinx, the number of times I've had to ask Democrats, like, what is this? Like, what? I don't know what it means. And I'm a highly engaged political individual. And I was like, what is this? And then, you know, there's some long explanation. And as a member of the, I was at a Dem thing. And one of the guys got up and said, I hear what you're saying about, you know, how difficult the trans issue is and how much, you know, we're losing on these cultural issues. But I want to be a good friend to LGBTQIA plus people. And he was like, he's like a 50-year-old middle-aged man trying to choke that out. And I was like, sir, as a member of the LGBTQIA plus community, please do not say all those letters. You don't need to. Like, you know, just, you know, the gays or like the, you know, just whatever. It's like, I was making jokes about being a lesbian in this contest, and I could feel the Democrats in the room like nervously laughing. And I swear to God, if Democrats don't figure out how to be more fun about the diversity in their party, like the way that it's, you want to be intersectional, then like make it great to be able to talk about all of our differences and in an open way, in a way that makes us feel connected to each other, not isolated in our little boxes. Like the way that Democrats have academized, I don't know what the word is, but the way that they've done that, it has sucked the lifeblood, the humanity out of like what the movement that is supposed to be about.
That's a good point. It makes people feel so worried that they're walking on eggshells all the time around Democrats.
And we're doing this in a moment where an openly racist guy is the president of the United States. Nick Fuentes is part of his coalition. We do not need to be so damn careful about this. The other side is absolutely vile. And why are we getting ourselves wrapped around the axle? I don't understand.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of the things that always strikes me is like, what a luxury the language stuff is. Like, if we have a, we can all afford, I guess, to live in the student union at an elite college campus. If democracy is humming along and the economy and everything else, like when fascism's at our doorstep, we might have to let some of this stuff go. And like the way that people say, like, well, don't throw trans people under the bus. And I'm just like, you know what the number one way you can protect trans people? Elect Democrats. Let them win. And like, and how do they win? Probably not by highlighting the trans sports issue. Like, you know, like, don't let the groups dictate what you say. These are 80-20 issues and you're on the wrong side of it. And which isn't to say, protect the dignity of every person. Say you're there for people. Okay. This idea of like, well, it's throwing trans people under the bus to say that, you know, a male swimmer who changes their sexual identity to become a female swimmer in college and gets this, like, that is not throwing trans people under the bus. Okay. That is not to say that that is not okay. Or that you oppose that is not the same thing as throwing trans people under the bus. Like there are ways to address these issues with humanity, but that are also politically resonant. But you actually asked about blacks and Hispanics. And I only want to say one last thing, which is the Republicans very intentionally built a multiracial, multi-ethnic working class coalition. Like they built one on purpose. And they do have a vile racist, but I listen to black people all the time who are like, I want to be rich. I want to be a business person. I think Donald, and they don't find Donald Trump. They think the Republicans are racist. But right. Donald Trump, because of his celebrity and because of the fact that he talks like a normal person, they like, it kind of slides in a way. And, you know, I think about that all the times that, so one of them was when Donald Trump got his mugshot and he was like, black people, they understand. And they're going to think this is, they're going to understand the solidarity of me with the mugshot. And I think all of us, including probably me, because like, it is a racist thing to say, right? You're like, this is racist. Except then I heard lots of black men be like, yeah, Donald Trump knows what it's like to have the cops come at you for no reason. Yeah. And so like he is tapping into people's grievance. A lot of it is just like economic insecurity. Like prices were too high. Like one of the main reasons Democrats lost is because of inflation and prices were too high, but they were willing to accept and overlook all of those things for Donald Trump because they didn't trust Democrats with the economy. And like, that's the problem.
Yeah. So can we talk about Hispanics for a second too? Because Hispanics, the number one reason that they gave their highest priority issue in 2024 was the economy, overwhelmingly. But in the intervening 7 months, Trump's support among Hispanics has taken a serious, serious hit. I mean, they are appalled at the way he is conducting these raids, and they know people who, you know, have been unjustifiably seized or harassed or whatever. And so, so they are softening in their support for him, which is encouraging. On the other hand, they are also still highly sensitive. They still rate the economy as the most important issue. So those things are a little bit TBD, would you say?
And they also hate Democrats still. They are turning on Trump and they do see the cruelty, but they don't like us either. The thing that worries me the most of any trend in American politics is what is happening with Hispanics, because it feels a lot like what happened with white ethnic voters in the 70s, where they became Reagan Democrats. The Italians. And the Poles.
Yep.
Right. And Poles, and the Irish, they were the Hispanics of the early 20th century. They were the ones that the nativists were attacking. Their grandfathers were the ones that were dealing with the same kind of racism that first and second generation Hispanics were dealing with here. They were the ones that dealt with, when we got to 15% foreign born population, everybody freaked out. You know, we slammed the golden door for 60 years. Things were bad. My dad has written a book many years ago about nativism in American history. It never leaves. It just becomes dormant for a while. And the ones who were the victims of that were the white ethnics. And then they became Republicans as they became third and fourth generation, as they moved up the economic scale, they built businesses and they did better. And that really, really worries me. Trump is doing everything he can to alienate them by being like arbitrary, insane, and cruel in the ways that they're going about the immigration enforcement, of course. But unless the economy turns down in some really serious way, I don't know that that's going to have a huge impact on this slide that we're seeing among Hispanic voters to the right. I don't know about African Americans. They may not be as attracted to the next generation of Republican leaders as they are to Trump, who is uniquely talented in certain respects. I don't know if they're going to find J.D. Vance or whoever a compelling leader, but I think Hispanics, it's much more ideological and worrying.
Sarah, you were saying, you know, that there's this gerontocracy running the Democratic Party. Where are the signs of leadership that you see?
Yeah, I mean, if I could take Mom Donnie's charisma and sort of smash it into Josh Shapiro's policy rubric, like, that would make me happy. Can I do that?
Yeah.
I think there was a period of time where I was looking at the Democratic field. This is probably around 22. And I was like, you know, there's a strong field coming up. Like, you had Gretchen Whitmer and Josh Shapiro and Wes Moore, Ossoff, you got two Democrats in Georgia. Like, there was just a bunch of people.
That guy from Kentucky, Beshear.
Beshear, you know, where you were like, okay, there's a lot of good governors, senators that are ideologically in a range. There was also your Alyssa Slotkins and your Abigail Spanbergers and your Mikey Shearals. Like, there's just a good class of people. And then, like, they've been confronted with Trump. Like, they're all being tested right now. And what you end up with are basically the people who are, I think, because they're temperamentally progressive, they are more willing to bring the fight, and you end, or the hyper ambitious to the point where it's slimy and people like recoil at it.
Newsom.
Yeah, right. You get a Newsom. But like, Gretchen Whitmer got tested. And Gretchen Whitmer failed.
Utterly.
Like, she stood next to Trump. She hit her face. I'm not sure her political instincts could have been worse.
Yeah.
And Josh Shapiro, who I still think very, very well of, you know, these are the moments where you build your name ID. These are the moments where you show people who you are. He could be, I think, very important in the Democratic internal rift between Israel and Gaza, and the way that that is sort of tearing the Democratic Party apart. I think to have a Jewish governor who's deeply popular in one of the most important swing states, being both very critical of Bibi while also defending, you know, his Jewish faith, and who has been attacked for his Jewish faith. Like, I think that there is a lot he could work with, but he's like, not like, I'm sort of, it's like the ambitious, what is that? It's the worst are filled with sound and fury, and the best lack all ambition. I can't remember.
Lack all conviction. Yeah.
I'm like sort of desperate for, like, even Abigail Spanberger, I think, is an enormous model of somebody who can be sort of a great legislator. And I think she's going to make a terrific governor. But even she sort of like kind of plays not to lose. Mikey's a little bit the same way. Like, they're just not out there defining the party. I think that Democrats, one of the reasons they're so angry and frustrated and feeling helpless is because and why they're gravitating to Newsom and what he's doing. So they're desperate for leadership. They're desperate for someone to follow and stand up and to say that things are as bad as they are, that what they're seeing with their eyes is real. And the Democratic Party as a whole isn't meeting that moment. Like, and so the voters, the Democrat, one of the things that has struck me is that Republican donors are pretty normal, but their voters are crazy. Democratic donors are often pretty crazy. The voters are pretty normal. Like, the Black voters are super moderate. You know, a lot of the college educated suburban voters, like, it is the rap on like who the base is of the Democratic Party, I think, is unfair. I think the Democratic Party's base is a bunch of pretty normal people. And those, you know who I see protesting? it's like 75-year-old men and women with very well-grammared signs who are out there, you know, and it's they're not blue-haired, you know, people with tattoos all over the place or whatever. It's like your average good citizen out there saying, no, I want American democracy to survive. And I just think that those people, the voters in the Democratic Party, are going to have to surface their own leaders through creating a mass movement that pushes back on this, because I just constantly have this sense that the leaders in the Democratic Party, such as they are, they're scared of their own shadow. They're built for a different era of politics, and you're going to need to surface new people for them to sort of meet this moment.
Matt, when you look at polling, you know, of Trump, you consistently see, you know, 65% disapprove of his handling of the economy, 62% disapprove of his handling of foreign policy, blah, 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 blah. Right down the line, people are so dissatisfied. Of course, all the Republicans are in lockstep in support. But if you look at Democrats and independents, you get to those numbers for the whole population in general, you know, 62, 63% disapprove. And I don't know, it strikes me that all you would need for a Democrat to be successful would be to present somebody who doesn't just repel people by being too woke or too lefty, but rather just speaks for average people, talks about prices, talks about democracy in a way that's very understandable, and talks about crime in a way, you know, just a moderate who doesn't repel people and isn't 85. Don't you think there would be a tremendous upsurge of support? Because Trump isn't popular.
Yeah, I do. And I certainly agree with Sarah about the hunger for leadership right now. And I basically agree with her take on the various leaders out there. I think there's a few others that are doing interesting things. I don't know if Rahm Emanuel is going to be our nominee, but he is an interesting guy saying interesting stuff. The problem for him is he doesn't have a platform. He's not in office right now. And there's others like him. It is a fluke of the American system that when you're out of power, you have no leader. There is no leader of the opposition in our system. And so, like in the British system, there is, and sometimes that's good, as it was with Keir Starmer when he was in opposition. And sometimes it's bad when Jeremy Corbyn was the leader of the opposition because he was a left-wing anti-Semitic nutcase. And so that was bad for the Labour Party. But when they had somebody that was a normie guy like Starmer, they ended up winning fairly easily. We will have that, but we won't have that for a long time. Ultimately, we will have a nominee. To Sarah's point, our voters are very normal. They are they vote like pundits in presidential races. I've literally seen, you've probably seen this too, Sarah, I've literally seen people say in focus groups in Iowa, well, I think the normal vote, the average voter would want this. I was like, you're in a focus group. Like, that's you. But that's what they're going to be, an enormous hunger for somebody that can win, that can beat the MAGA forces, whoever leads them. And I think we will end up, I do not think we will end up with a radical. I think we will end up with a moderate, as we have pretty much every cycle since 1992. And I don't know who that's going to be, because another thing in our system is people seem like they might be good presidential candidates, but you don't know until they are one. I mean, Ron DeSantis was supposed to be good at it and couldn't hit a major league fastball, as it turns out. You know, he was a good AAA hitter. And we don't know who's going to be good until they all start running. I think there are some people that might be. I think Wes Moore is a really interesting guy. Like he is dynamic and, you know, he's made some mistakes and I think he's a little hyper cautious, but who knows? Bashir, but they may suck. You know, Whitmer, everybody had a lot of hope. And then as Sarah points out, she kind of fell on her face. So we won't know until it all gets going, and that won't get going until after the midterm.
Hey, Matt, what did you think about the, I saw the suggestion, because I think Ken Martin, who's doing, like, as we said about the DNC, I think he's doing a terrible job.
Horrible.
What do you make of the idea of having sort of an early primary, which was something that was floated, or some kind of candidate forums to kind of get these guys? That was the one thing that came out of the DNC that I was like, I actually think they should maybe start doing this. Like, you got to give a platform to people. And there's never too early even though it's bad for us in our politics, it is literally never too early to start talking about 2028. And so why not give people some kind of a formal platform to start talking about the issues?
Yeah, I think that would be fine. I think, as we know, of course, only the super dialed in will be paying attention then. And then it does disadvantage both Moore and Shapiro because they got to run for re-election next year. And Shapiro's is not a slam dunk, as you well know. He will probably win. And if he does, that'll be a really good thing for him because he will have won twice in Pennsylvania, which is like the center of the target in the general election of the presidential. But nevertheless, like he's got to do, it's the phony war period where he's got to pretend that he's not interested in running for president. I mean, perish the thought. Of course, all he wants to do is become governor again. And so he's got to like play this game with donors and play this game with national Democrats. And so I think it would be very tricky for them. Be easy for Rahm, easy for Bashir and Newsom, these guys who are termed or don't have jobs, but harder for those guys.
Do you see any possible pitfalls for 2026 in the sense that, you know, looking back at 2018, Democrats did super well and learned some of the wrong lessons from that? Certainly Biden did. Do you think there are pitfalls? Look, we now know that the Democrats are going to be the party that profits from a lower turnout election. So this is going to be an off cycle. So it already favors the Democratic Party. And if the economy is not doing well, so I don't know. But what do you see as possible pitfalls from 2026 in terms of choosing, finding a candidate for 2028?
Yeah, I really worry about the false positive. And we got that in 2022 when we barely survived the midterms. I mean, we almost—
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, I meant 2022, not 2018. Right. Yeah, sorry.
In 22, you know, we just barely beat Kerry Lake, who is a psychopath, mm-hmm. Who is running for the to be governor of a major state who in a swing state. Mm-hmm. We barely eked out wins in the places where we desperately had to win if we had any hope of having a real presidential election in 2024. And then, as it turns out, none of that mattered because Trump won fair and square. But the lesson that Biden took was everyone loves me, which was nuts. And so he ran again. And the lesson the party took was everything's fine, also nuts. So we cannot allow that to happen. I do think in the kind of don't fight the last war thing, I do think the one good thing is, I think a lot of Democrats understood that we drew the wrong lessons out of 22. In 2018, though, by contrast, a whole bunch of moderates won in those races. We you know, kind of beat Trump pretty bad. We got, I think, 34 moderates flipped seats in the same cycle that the Squad came on the scene. AOC won her primary against Joe Crowley. Everybody got all excited. A Democratic socialist in a weird June primary in New York City, a young, dynamic, telegenic, DSA member, sounds kind of familiar. And so we've got to make sure that between this year and next, we draw the right lessons. And the lessons are, if you're Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill, if you're Janelle Stetson, if you're, you know, Paige Cognetti in Scranton, if you're these moderates that can flip seats, that matters. And turning a blue place bluer like New York City does not matter. And if we can draw those lessons and the party moves in that direction, that could be helpful.
Okay. Last question. I'm going to play devil's advocate. Okay. I'm going to be the progressive. And I'm going to say, it's not just about, you know, playing it safe and trying to be moderate. You have to energize your base. Otherwise, they're not going to be excited enough to do the work and to go to the polls. The fact is Barack Obama is nobody's idea of a moderate. And look, he swept all before him because he excited people and he really believed in things and so on. And Mamdani is doing the same thing. And you are just, you know, overlooking a very important part of politics, which is the excitement and the passion that comes from true belief. How do you respond?
our good friend Bill Galston and my friend Nalin Kamar co-authored a paper called The Politics of Evasion, in which one of the chapters of their paper was The Myth of Mobilization. And what they wrote was Democrats harbor this myth that if we have enough excitement in our base, that will mobilize voters that are low propensity and that will sweep us to victory. And they wrote that paper in 1986. This is not a new thing. And it was true then, and it has been true every single cycle since. And the one time it was not a myth, the one time that we had a very exciting candidate mobilize voters that might not have voted otherwise was 2008.
Donald Trump.
Our side. To be sure, Trump did it too. But our side has done it once with a world historic figure and a generational talent who actually did kind of run as a moderate. If you look back at what Obama was saying, and then he governed as a moderate, to be sure, to the great disappointment of the left. And so it just is baloney. It does not work ever anywhere unless it's like all the stars align perfectly. So our view is base voters in an election where, that seems existential as 2024 did and as 2028 certainly will, with Donald Trump having basically destroyed everything that we care about in the interim, they're going to be there. The question is, can we get back the voters that we have lost? The people that voted for Biden in 20 and Trump in 2024, those Hispanics that have drifted away from us, the African Americans that lost faith in us, the white working class, we got to get it back at least a little. We can't lose in such overwhelming numbers. If we can't do that, and if we can't tell those people that we are not freaks, that we do not sound like a bunch of people that they hate, that feel that we are patronizing them, that we're not talking about things they don't want in language they don't like, we're going to lose again. But if we can learn those lessons, then I think we have a pretty good shot at winning.
I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me, Matt Bennett, Sarah Longwell, and thank you all for being part of this podcast.